Good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I'm calling this meeting of the committee to order. This meeting is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type, and welcome to all. The meeting materials have been sent to members and to staff that are on the Zoom call, and members of the public, those materials have been posted to our committee website, which you can find. We're going to start, as usual, with the call of the roll. Ms. Chambers, if you can do that.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels. Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wasliwick.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, and I did see Representative Franson on with us as well, and so I want to make sure to note her appearance. If I can have a motion from our Vice Chair, Representative Pryor, to approve the minutes from February 9th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And any additions or corrections to those minutes, members? And not hearing any, all in favor of approval of the February 9th minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
And so the motion passes, the minutes are approved. And I should note Representative Daniels has joined us, is with us as well. So glad to have you. Members, as I mentioned, the end of the last hearing, the hearing today is gonna be a series of programs and funding streams and items that are under the jurisdiction of the Department of Education and under our committee's jurisdiction as well. As I mentioned, we're going to try to fit a heck of a lot in a short amount of time. And so I want to apologize in advance to, in particular, to our presenters, if I need to be a little bit strict on the different time segments and make sure we fit in as much as we can. Members, as usual, if you have substantive questions, hold them to the end, at least of each segment. Again, apologies to presenters that if members have some clarifying questions, and I'll do this too, we may stop you just in order to address things right then and there, but we'll keep things moving. Our first presenter is, I believe, Ms. Hewitt. And so if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Hewitt. I am Interim Director of Early Learning Services, and I'm here today with several colleagues who will introduce themselves as they begin to speak. And I want to thank you for inviting us to present today. We've been asked to provide an overview of the early learning program supported by MDE. And next slide. We are the early learning services team, so we'll be focusing on starting early, but we see ourselves in each of these 10 commitments to equity. Next slide. These are the programs that we hope to introduce you to today, and we've got a lot to cover. We want to provide you with thorough slides, but we'll keep our comments at a high level. If we're not able to get to all of the information that you're interested in, please let us know so that we can follow up with you. I don't want to belabor the importance of the early years because I know you've had several speakers, but just to get us grounded this morning, I'll highlight that development is strongly influenced by interactions with other people and environments, including participation in early learning programs, and that there is a high rate of return on investment in pre-K when those investments are strongly tied to the level of quality. Next slide. We use a comprehensive pre-P P3 approach, which means that the early years are considered birth to age 8 or grade 3, and that the high quality early learning care and education system requires a comprehensive approach that focuses on work inside and outside of classrooms. Outside of classroom kind of supports are structural, such as a workforce that is skilled and compensated in alignment with their education and experience, and that there is alignment between pre-K and grade 3 in instruction and curriculum. Inside classroom supports for quality are things like well-prepared learning environments with welcoming spaces for children, and engaging families by developing relationships that foster two-way communication. Next slide. So last time I was here a couple weeks ago, I talked about how school-based early learning programs sit at a unique intersection. And I thought that this slide would help to visualize that. We need to align horizontally with community programs and policies that are appropriate for the age band. And as part of the school system, we need to align vertically as children progress through the school system. What we want is for children and families to experience transitions that are as seamless as possible as they progress from early learning into the early grades. Next slide. In early learning services, we see ourselves as part of each of the key priorities in the Due North Plan. But I wanted to draw your attention to a few. Even young children have experienced some sort of trauma as a result of the pandemic. The degree of the trauma will vary with each individual and their circumstances. We believe that every student needs a safe and nurturing school environment where their family, culture, and language is valued and viewed as an asset. And early learning or early child is experiencing a workforce crisis, and we need more and more diverse teachers who are well-prepared, supported, and compensated for their education and experience. Next slide. The Early Childhood Indicators of Progress are Minnesota's early learning standards. And standards are a shared set of expectations of what children can know and do. And when we hold the same expectations across program types and settings, it ensures that all children have access to challenging content. The ESEPs are aligned with kindergarten to third grade standards and include 8 areas of learning or domains. These provide the foundation on which curriculum, assessment, and instruction are built, and they're the primary focus for professional development and family partnerships. While children are learning at all ages, several factors need to be in place to help children be prepared for success in school. Schools need to be able to accept children where they're at and their skill development when they walk in the door. Families need to know how to support their children's learning. Communities need to provide services to enhance health, safety, and economic stability of all children and families. And children shouldn't need to bring anything except their unique characteristics, skills, experiences, and an eagerness to learn. Next slide. Our early childhood growth and development screening assists parents and communities in early detection of factors that may hinder a child's learning, growth, or development. Screening is made up of a short set of tasks for the child, which they often see as playing games. They do a height and weight check, do vision and hearing check, and screening staff have conversations with the parent or guardian. The target age is 3 to 4 years old, and screening is often the criteria for enrollment in a program. It helps identify children who need further evaluation and connect children and families to additional resources. The school readiness, the program, was first funded in 2005. It, like many of the other early learning programs, prepares children to enter kindergarten. It prioritizes children ages 3 to kindergarten with a identified risk factor, such as qualifying for free and reduced price lunch, experiencing homelessness, on an IEP, a multilingual learner, identified by screening as having a potential risk factor, or a risk factor that has been prioritized by the district. Those who don't meet eligibility can still participate on a sliding fee scale. There are several program requirements, such as assessing students at entry and exit to the program for program improvement and to inform practice. They provide comprehensive content and intentional instruction and coordinate kindergarten transition.
Ms. Hewitt, actually, if we can go back to the prior slide, we do have a clarifying question. Representative Fryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was actually the slide before, slide 10.
Okay, let's go back to that. Representative Fryer.
And I just wanted to take another look at it. So among, you know, there's so much that we're missing out during the pandemic, but the amount of screening has also gone down. It looks pretty considerably from 2019. So just wanted to make sure that I saw that correctly. That's, I guess, just another one of those things that we're gonna have to be thinking about what we've missed out and how we can make up for it in the future.
Thanks for calling that out, Representative Pryor. And I think it probably makes some, I think we probably have a good sense, Ms. Hewitt, of why that is. If there's anything you wanna add, but otherwise, please just feel free to continue.
The Early Childhood Family Education Program provides parenting education to support children's learning, help boost parenting skills, increase knowledge of child development, and helps parents overcome other potential stressors. This program serves children, birth to kindergarten, and their parents, expectant parents, and relatives. It's available to all families through all districts. The program is universal, but districts conduct an extensive community needs assessment and prioritize serving families with the most risk factors, birth to age 3, in their communities. Programs work to ensure that their classes reflect racial, cultural, and economic diversity of the school district that they're in. And many work to reduce barriers by offering classes in the evening, on Saturdays. They offer transportation oftentimes and arrange for classes to be set up in community buildings or apartment buildings to make it easily accessible. Classes are taught by parent educators and children's teachers, and like other programs, they're experiencing teacher shortages. No family is turned away due to cost. And now I'll hand it off to Ms. Yetter.
Please, Ms. Yetter, identify yourself for the record and then continue.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Yetter. I'm the school finance director here at the Department of Education. The next few slides will talk about the funding for the programs that Ms. Hewitt just covered. Early childhood screening aid reimburses districts based on the number of students or the number of children screened. There's a different reimbursement rate for each age. It's $75 for 3-year-old screen, $50 for 4-year-olds, and $40 for 5 or 6-year-olds. The rate of screening is higher for younger children to encourage districts to be screened at an earlier age. And districts can receive funding if a child is screened multiple times. So there is some encouragement for early screening and then repeat screening. The point that was made, the pandemic has caused in the spring the number of screenings to be down from what had been seen for schools. And so legislation was passed last spring to help to support the budgeting and stability for the screening program. So rather than for FY20 and FY21, the funding level for the districts, rather than being on the number of students screened as it typically is, the funding is based on what was provided for FY19. So what that does is basically supports the program budget for screening for districts, over the course of the pandemic. Then for school readiness funding, this is an amount of aid of $33 million that's set in statute. This amount's divided in half, and then one half is allocated to the districts based on their four-year-old population. The other half is allocated to schools based on the number of students eligible for free and reduced price meals. School readiness revenue must be reserved in the community service fund, and it can only be used for the purposes of this program. In addition to this aid, it can also include fees, grants, and other sources of revenue. The amount of school finance or school readiness aid may not be adequate, so districts may charge fees to support the cost of these programs. When charging fees, a district must adopt a sliding scale schedule based on family income, and they must waive the fee if the participant is unable to pay. Then for early childhood family education, this revenue is not based on students and families participating in the program, but it's rather based on the total population age 0 through 4 in the district. And so for this year, the revenue for the program is equal to $151 times the 0 to 4 population. The rate that's used for calculating the revenue is tied to the general education formula allowance. And so what that does is it allows for the allowance to be increased automatically every year that there's a formula allowance increase that's enacted in the statute. And then for very small districts, there's a minimum guarantee in the formula so that the revenue would be calculated based on 150 zero to four population rather than the actual population of the district. And so for this year, that guarantees a minimum amount of $22,000 for small districts. There's a levy component to the revenue. The levy share of the revenue is based on a uniform tax rate that's set in statute, and it's set to raise $22 million statewide. Districts with a high tax base are limited to the amount of revenue that's raised by the revenue formula. And then the aid comes in to make up the difference between what's raised by the district and the levy and the total amount of revenue that they're entitled to.
Ms. Yetter, real quick question, if I can. ANTC, the reference there, what I think that's a tax term that I'm sorry that I'm spacing on. What does that mean?
Yes, thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. Sometimes we get stuck with our a little bit too much detail. There's several tax bases that are used for calculating school district levies. Adjusted net tax capacity is the one that's most commonly used for the community service programs, the levies kind of outside of general education, referendums, that sort of thing. And so this is just the tax-based measure that's used for determining the share of state aid and local property tax levies for these programs.
That's helpful. Thanks so much. Please continue.
Then also for the early childhood family education program, revenue must be reserved for this program in the community service fund also. It's used and then also used only for the purposes for the program. This would include ECFE formula revenue, and it also includes fees and grants and other types of revenue that might be charged to that account. No more than 5% of the revenue can be used for administration, and then up to 10% may be used for equipment purchases that are used for the program. And then as with school readiness, districts can charge fees for the program. It would be still on a sliding scale basis. And they must be waived if the participant is unable to pay those fees. Then we have a home visiting revenue program. This actually supports the ECFE program, and schools are allowed to levy for home visiting revenue if they participate in ECFE. And so here the revenue was an additional $3 based on the district's 0-4 population again. The levy here, there's a levy and an aid in this program, and the levy share is calculated at a relatively high rate for the program. So most districts do receive state aid to support the levy that they make to generate the revenue. To be eligible for the revenue, the district must enter into a collaborative agreement to provide education and social services to families with young children. And this revenue is also reserved along with the ECFE revenue.
Ms. Yoder, just a question on that you mentioned the collaborative agreement to provide education and social services to families with young children. Is that specifically then for ECFE, or do districts use that for other things as well?
I think that because of the fact that it's reserved as part of the ECFE reserve, I believe that it is for this program specifically, but I can check on that and get back to you with that.
That would be great.
Ms. Hewitt does know the answer to that question.
Oh, Ms. Hewitt, if you could just answer that real quick.
I don't have additional information.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Ms.
Sorry, I think I misunderstood. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, if you can get that to us later. And please continue, Ms. Yetter.
Then the next slide just shows how much revenue by source we have for the three programs that have the specific funding sources. And this is based on our actual financial reporting from school districts for FY20. What you see here, ECFE, is primarily supported by the formula that I discussed with the state aid and local property tax levies, but also fees and other miscellaneous local income also supports this program at about 11% of the total revenue. There is a pre-kindergarten line here that is a small amount of revenue. This does not tie directly to the three programs that have specific revenue sources. What this is for districts are reporting within preschool, pre-kindergarten programs, if they've allocated a portion of their general education revenue to support other pre-kindergarten programs. And then about half of this would be allocations to the school readiness program. What you see on the school readiness line is that the state aid pays for about 31 million of the 55 million total, but fees and other local revenues account for a much more significant share for providing services within this program. So that's about 38% of the total revenue that's spent on the program. And then you see ECFE early childhood screening is primarily being supported by the state aid that's provided for the program. Then at this point, we can pause for any other questions.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And just a reminder to members that these slides are a rich source of information for us to refer to, and we really appreciate you bringing them up. Let's go back to why don't we bring the PowerPoint down just for a second. And I don't know if we'll have questions at this point from members. I see Representative Bolden has one. So Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the presenters for this really important and interesting information. My question is specific to the early childhood health and development screening, and apologies if you shared this and I missed it, but I'm wondering if we know the percentage of kiddos across the state who are screened versus the ones who are not. And then my follow-up question to that is, in looking from a racial equity lens, do we, and wanting to be sure that we are, you know, getting all the resources possible, possible to our communities of color. Do we know sort of the racial breakdown of the kiddos who are screened and aren't screened to perhaps kind of key into who we are missing?
Ms. Hewitt.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have that information. I can provide it for you at another time. I know that we have done extensive work to train people in districts to do outreach to communities in their district and make sure that we're reaching as many children as possible, as early as possible from all different areas in their community, and that we are able to screen almost all children by the time they enter kindergarten, with a few that we need to catch up on in kindergarten. And I can get you those figures.
And Ben, please do make, yeah, please do send that to us and follow up after this hearing. That'd be great. And it looks like Representative Bolden does not have a follow-up. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like to continue to follow up with what Representative Bolden just brought up too. You know, we know that there's a lot of kids that didn't go to kindergarten this year. And so I guess probably I am thinking that this information is going to be pretty critical to understanding, you know, that gap. This is a gap year for a lot of kids. And if who we are missing and where they lived and how we can reach to them, and that we'll have to have a plan for, even if it's first grade, that we're catching up from what we lost before. So I appreciate Representative Bolden's question and realize how important that is, that we find out how many we missed and who they are.
Thank you. And I'll just one quick question for me about screening, the screening aids. This is maybe to Ms. Yetter, how those figures that we saw compared to the cost. Do we have any sense as to the cost districts? Are those amounts covering the cost? $75 for a 3-year-old, $50 for a 4-year-old, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The slide that I showed just shows the revenue that's coming in. From what I'm understanding, I don't think it covers the full cost, but I can get that information to you.
Thank you. It looks like Ms. Hewitt may have something to add to that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We know that several districts do have to supplement the cost of screening, especially as additional interpreters are needed, and that the cost of interpreters can really increase the rate that's needed per child.
Okay, thank you, thank you. Any other questions from members right now? And not seeing any, I know we got a lot to get through. And members, by the way, we sort of have a total of about 60 minutes of a presentation that we've discussed. And so just for your planning purposes, to get through those many programs you saw at the beginning. So why don't we keep on moving then? And I think Ms. Hewitt, that you're up next for the next phase. And so please proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, actually, hold on one moment if you can. I think I actually missed the Chair Dabney had a question. If we can come back to the screen here. And Chair Dabney, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't mean to yank us back. I just wasn't sure where my question best fit in from Ms. Hewitt. You spoke earlier in your presentation about the importance of a vertical and horizontal alignment and emphasized that quality early childhood is enhanced by strong K through 3 kind of follow through. And I'm wondering, what are the elements of alignment between our preschool policy and K-3? And how do we measure that alignment between an early childhood provider of some sort and the K-12 system?
Ms. Hewitt.
Representative and Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. We are working hard to look at P3 and the alignment as the cohesive experience for the child and the family. And components of that experience would be aligned curriculum, one that builds on the what's been learned in the past and keeps scaffolding, instructional practices that are similar so that you build to an activity at the end of pre-K and then start it at the beginning of kindergarten so that children feel comfortable and confident in making that transition and it's easier for them. There are professional development experiences that teachers and staff can have that help smooth out the expectations that you have and the better understanding of where children are coming from and where they're going next, as well as additional supports through the administrative practices. So there's both the inside and outside of the classroom activities that help support those comprehensive alignment pieces. And it's really helpful to a child when they understand and can progress in their own learning in a way that is supported by adults who have commonalities in their practices and in their approaches to their education.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you. That's a start of a conversation, I think. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Thank you, Ms. Hewitt.
And Chair Dabney, thanks for raising that because, yeah, that's sort of a step back kind of a question that we need to be keeping in mind throughout this. So I really appreciate it. So Ms. Hewitt, then let's get going with Head Start and we'll keep ourselves moving.
So Head Start and Early Head Start uses a two-generation approach focusing on child and family development. It helps low-income families set and meet their goals, such as finding long-term housing, food security, and obtaining medical supports. And it also helps children be prepared for school success. Head Start and Early Head Start provide these comprehensive services to families at or below 100% of the federal poverty guidelines. And Early Head Start programs serve infants and toddlers under the age of 3 and pregnant women. They oftentimes, Early Head Start can have both center-based and home visiting programs. In the home visiting programs, they really focus on supporting attachment by helping focus on engagement with the child, building on strengths of the parent, and can catch developmental issues early if there are any. Head Start is oftentimes center-based preschool services that can be half day and full day. The Head Start also really focuses on and promotes parent leadership through training and opportunities such as their parent policy council. In Minnesota, we have 33 agencies that operate 34 early Head Start and Head Start programs. 8 of these are tribal programs and they're located throughout Minnesota. Next slide. The greatest portion of funding for this program comes from federal grants directly to local programs. But Minnesota is one of a handful of states that provide state funds to serve additional children. And these general funds are allocated using a formula. Next slide. This slide shows the blue line and it shows how the federal funding has increased over time. The green line is state funding that has remained relatively flat. Our voluntary pre-kindergarten, we call VPK, is another program that helps prepare children for success as they enter kindergarten. VPK was first funded in school year 2016-17, so is in the 5th year of operation. And in relationship to other types of early learning programs, it's still in its infancy or maybe moving into toddlerhood. This funding makes early learning a grade within the E12 system, and fees can't be charged for any child attending a VPK classroom. There's an annual application process for early learning funding that supports both VPK and the next program that I'll talk about, which is School Readiness Plus. A ranking of applications required through the statute gives priority to schools within a region with higher concentrations of free and reduced lunch. And since VPK seats are limited, districts and charters can prioritize children with risk factors. School Readiness Plus, or SRP, separates children, or prepares children for success as they enter kindergarten the next year. It offers free programming to children with one or more risk factors that are the same as school readiness program and adds foster care. And children who do not have one of the risk factors can attend on a sliding fee basis if the school has capacity. VPK and School Readiness Plus programs are more alike than they are different. Only slight differences in their requirements. Most notably, School Readiness Plus requires one licensed teacher in each classroom. VPK requires salaries that are comparable to K-12, and VPK requires the professional development, or PD, and instruction that's aligned to third grade. During the application process, districts and charters indicate which program standards they're going to implement, VPK or School Readiness Plus. In fiscal year 20, of the 117 districts offering VPK School Readiness Plus, 9 chose to implement the School Readiness Plus standards. This slide demonstrates that since the startup of these programs, there's been a steady increase in district capacity to fully utilize the allocation. Currently, these programs serve a total of approximately 7,160 children. 4,000 of these seats are set to expire the end of June. Districts remain highly interested in offering these programs. New funding was requested by 123 districts and charter schools in this last application for a total of an additional request for 6,000 more seats. Next slide. The kindergarten entry profile, known as KEP, is made up of standards-based formative assessments that produce information that can help teachers, administrators, and families better understand what students know and are able to do. Data from the KEP approved assessments, along with other important information, can be used to guide planning, instruction, and continuous program improvement. These assessment tools can be used in two ways. One is for the tools to be used by kindergarten teachers who volunteer to assess students in the first 6 to 8 weeks of school to help obtain information about the readiness of the incoming class. Originally, this was intended to be a representative sample, but due to the voluntary nature of the program and the limited budget, there are significant challenges to recruiting and maintaining participation, especially during a pandemic. Unfortunately, the data is a sample and it is not representative of our state's kindergarten students, so we're unable to draw accurate conclusions about the general population through this voluntary program. A second use of the KEP approved assessment tools is in VPK and School Readiness Plus. And here districts choose one of the 4 approved kindergarten entry profile tools. Teachers gather information in everyday classroom activities and routines. And when analyzed, it provides information to plan instruction and interactions. When collected at the entry and exit of the program, it can show progress over time. MDE has invested in building a data submission and reporting system that if districts choose to submit their data, which most do, they receive district and classroom reports. The allocation for this program has remained at $281,000 since 2013.
Ms. Hewitt, if I can pause you for a second, Representative Cattizzi-Batun has a question. Representative Cattizzi-Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm just curious. I know that this is a voluntary process for the districts across the state, but is there what does the training requirement look like for those who would be giving the assessment? Has there ever been a possibility for, you know, the PTA or the PTO or parents to volunteer as classroom volunteers and participate in and help administer these assessments?
Ms. Hewitt.
Representative Pinto and Representative, not to my knowledge have we used parents. It's a teacher who receives training on the individual on the individual assessment tool, and because they are so tied to the indicators of progress, they need a high level of understanding of those standards and the tools themselves, and so are administered by the teacher in an everyday activity with work samples and then analysis.
Representative Cattizzi-Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hewitt. That makes sense. I was just curious.
Great. Let's continue then, Ms. Hewitt. Thanks.
And at this time, I would turn it to my colleague, Ms. Hayden.
Ms. Hayden, please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Danielle Hayden. I'm the Early Childhood Special Education Supervisor for the Department of Education, and I work under the Early Learning Services Division. I'm going to talk with you today about the two components of special education services as they pertain to early childhood students. The first being Part B 619. These are our students who've been entitled to free and appropriate public education based on eligibility for special education services from the age of 3 until their enrollment in kindergarten. We currently have a December 1 count of 11,940 students across the state that meet this eligibility by either showing a delay in two or more areas and qualifying for a developmental delay label. Otherwise, they are also able to qualify for categorical disability labels as well. Huge components of this particular program are providing special education services based on their identified needs from their evaluations and IEP determinations. And those services can be provided in the home, community, or preschool settings. Those preschools could be community preschools, or they could also be school district preschools. There are a lot of opportunities for district level early childhood special education programs and general education programs to collaboratively provide programs for all students in the districts. The focus again is on least restrictive environment and inclusive settings. So building capacity for opportunities for our ECSE students to receive services with their general ed peers is a big priority. We have a statewide professional development system that is funded by the Department of Education's grants from OSEP for the pyramid model and classroom engagement model. These are two high quality best practice implementations that school districts can apply for and receive really robust training over a 5-year period of time to build capacity and independence in the school districts for continuing that process. Another key component of our special education programs, both Part E and Part C, are our Help Me Grow and Help Me Connect systems. Help Me Grow is a statewide platform that was designed to support families in receiving resources, as well as a child find and outreach platform. It's also an opportunity for families or providers within the community to make referrals for students to be received by school districts in which they reside to determine whether or not evaluation and ongoing supports is warranted. Outcome measures for this particular group, and it's timely that it follows Debbie's conversation about the kindergarten entry profiles in that ECSE has made a concerted effort to encourage the use of these profiles in our early childhood special education programs to use as our rating scales for entry and exit, which we're required to report on to the Office of Special Education Programs at the national level to monitor our child's development and the rate in which they are building skills to close the gap between themselves and peers. This program is provided through funding from federal grants as well as state aid. The state aid for early childhood special education Part B services also has a transportation aid component, as all of our children are entitled to transportation based on their age. Next slide.
I'm actually going to pause you for a second. Representative Wasilewicz has a question. Representative Wasilewicz. Looks like another one as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Ms. Hayden, if you could, on the slide that was just up, it mentioned special education services and childcare settings. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what that is or what that looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wasilewicz. Thank you. Community childcare and home-based childcare is an opportunity for us to work with those providers. Oftentimes school districts, if they have the capacity to do so, will identify team members from within their staffing that would go to those locations to provide those consultative services. They're a little less robust in the sense that these are students that are doing well in their environments, and we're trying to build capacity of the staff to maintain them. The advantage of those opportunities is that we often end up supporting and encouraging the maintenance of children in programs, which ultimately helps family outcomes.
Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, that's all, thanks.
Okay, Representative Pryor. We'll get you on mute. There we go.
Sometimes I think I should lower my hand before I unmute myself, but I probably should just go ahead and unmute myself. So a couple questions, and you know, just it's like, okay, we're trying to understand on a good broad level everything that's going on. So do children qualify or for this early childhood special education? Is that something that comes out of those that we talked about before, those assessments that are done?
Ms. Hayden. Well, maybe Ms. Hayden can sort of help decipher, help us pull out. So Ms. Hayden, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor. There's a couple different components here, and I don't know how far in the weeds to get. When children are referred for concerns with development, that is referred to the special education team. Sometimes those teams can choose to refer the child through early childhood screening first. Sometimes that's our first measure of defense. Other times there's the warrant is there for us to continue straight into an evaluation. Those evaluations have multiple different components of criteria that are required based on the eligibility criteria standard that's been set. Oftentimes that includes really comprehensive and robust evaluation tools to be used that are different than the tools in the kindergarten entry profile. However, the kindergarten entry profiles can be used to support the more standardized testing tools that we use within our eligibility criteria to determine those. Each different eligibility criteria has different components that are required.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I understand a little bit better because I'm assuming that when you're qualifying for early childhood special education, there can be a huge range of what that actually means in terms of the need for a special education. And I can well imagine how that might vary. But then also, and then given that huge range of what the needs might be for an individual child, then the goal being how close you can bring that child up into where their peers are as they enter kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And so then but again, you know, there probably are some children that will never have the same profiles and the same skills that their peers have, even when they enter kindergarten, and know what that means in terms of early childhood special education. But yet So is there then, given that, is there some kind of assessment of where we stand for success and also how we look for those equity gaps? That, you know, these are children, children of color entering this program versus their peer, white peers entering the program. And are we able to assess how we're doing in terms of equity for providing these early childhood special education?
Ms. Hayden, anything to add on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor. Yes. There is a good deal of opportunity that we have to assess our data and to look at the outcomes of children based on race and cultural background and language. We're building a data system right now, and it's been in process for a few years that will allow us to return or turn that information over to districts in a more timely manner so that they can better analyze and respond to that data. That's been a concerted effort of the agency for a very concerted amount of time. And then the outcomes, yes, there's such a range in terms of what children are brought into the world with factors that impact how they're going to develop between environment or genetic or other conditions that are known to cause ongoing concerns. The goal is to intervene as early as possible with as much support as possible to have them as ready as possible to enter those kindergarten classrooms with their peers. And then their programs are differentiated for them as they arrive.
Thank you. Please, looks like Representative Pryor, all done.
One more,
that's okay, yeah. I'll ask you maybe keep it quick if you can. We got a lot to get
to. And just understand too, you know, we're hearing about in the K-12 that this idea that a child might be labeled as needing special education and that that there are race differences in how a child is, as you know, the expression being labeled. And so, you know, again, now that I'm here thinking about this applying to the earliest of ages, how much is our awareness of again, these racial differences and looking at this with the equity lens?
And Ms. Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor. It's a huge awareness, and it's a conversation that's happening continuously as we meet with leaders across the state, but as leaders are leading their programs and talking about students. The fortunate piece that we have in early childhood is that we have the developmental delay label, so we're not having to look at really robust categorical labels that have really negative connotations historically, like emotionally behavioral disorder and the over-identification of African-American males in that particular category. So we're very cognizant of it, and we're working to improve our practice all the time and to gain family trust and collaboration in the process.
Thank you. Ms. Hayden, please continue then.
Yeah, so the next slide I have is with regards to our Part C program. Our Part C program is a program for our children that are birth to age 3. This program is incredibly special in that it really focuses on building capacity of families and engaging families in the process of providing their students or their children, sometimes referred to as babies and toddlers, with support and services throughout their daily routines and lives. The bulk of the services in Part C are provided in their home environments or their daycare environments, looking at the routines of the family or the childcare setting to support their child's development. It's a coaching model. It's more about providing support and services to the family than it is about providing intervention, so to speak, or therapy to the child itself. Again, we have our statewide development for professional development, and the particular innovation that applies to this population is our evidence-based quality intervention practices. And it's all about the coaching of families and caregivers in their child's development. Two other really important components that are different from our Part B, though we apply and consider Part B in this work, is our interagency coordinating council that's appointed by the governor. That works to advise and coordinate our statewide system of early intervention. And then we have our IEICs, which is an intervention early childhood council that is regional representation so that we can look at our programs and outreach across the state. And those regions are able to target their communities in very individualized ways as appropriate. Part C also has federal indicators. We have our child outcomes, so children are assessed and rated and reported on entry and exit. And then the additional piece that we measure with our children that are leaving our Part C programs is how families are feeling as their child's moving on to the next level, in terms of how we've helped to build their capacity to understand their child's development, to be able to advocate for their child's needs as they move through through the early learning system, as well as the K-12 system. Again, the funding comes from both federal and state. The difference with state here is that there's travel aid because the staff are often traveling between homes or childcare centers. There is a reimbursement oftentimes, or these monies are used to pay for designated vehicles for staff to use for these home visits. And I think we go back to Ms. Hewitt.
Or maybe Ms. Yetter, perhaps.
Ms. Yetter, I think. Sorry about
that. That's okay. No problem. Ms. Yetter, please carry on here.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Carrie Yetter, again with the Department of Education. And I'll talk a little bit about the funding for the BPK SM Plus programs and for early childhood special education. As Ms. Hewitt mentioned, the BPK SR Plus is nearly works as an added grade level for purposes of funding these programs, although it's not available to all districts since the number of participating sites and students is capped. Participating students are counted in the district's enrollment, average daily membership, and pupil units, and that's the same with all other grade levels. Preschool students at participating sites can generate up to 0.6 pupil units. There's it's a calculation based on the number of hours and days within the program. So it can vary across programs from something around 0.4 to a maximum of 0.6 pupil units. Since these students are counted in the school districts and charter schools enrollments and ADMs, they generate funding for all pupil-driven funding formulas within the general fund. And so general education revenue is the principal source of funding the programs for BPK and SR Plus. But these students also generate additional revenue for other programs that are based on pupils. And that includes programs such as charter school lease aid, achievement and integration revenue, and long-term facilities maintenance for the school districts and charter schools. Students participating in these programs may not also generate revenue for early learning programs in the community service fund. So this it's for the hours that they're spending in the BPK or SR Plus funding or programs, they generate just that revenue for those students during that time period. Then on the next slide, there's a chart here that shows the breakdown of the revenue that's generated by the students in these programs for FY21. And so you see here that of the total roughly $41 million that's generated by these students, the majority of that is within the general education revenue program. So that's almost 37 million of the total. But you also see for the other various programs, the amount of dollars that are generated for the school districts and charter schools that are participating in the programs. Then for early childhood special education funding, as Ms. Hayden mentioned, this is also included as more or less as a grade level in terms of generating funding for all the pupil-driven formulas within the general fund. And so here, for students that have an IEP, are also included in, again, the enrollment counts, ADM, and pupil units. For students with IEPs, they would generate a minimum of 0.28 ADM for the instructional programming, and can also generate a small amount of ADM to pay for their participation in evaluation services. And this primarily, again, generates general education revenue associated with these students. ECSC students also generate special education aid to provide funding for the special education services that they receive. And this is the same as for all other students at any other grade level, where the funding is largely based on the cost of providing special ed services to these students. And then state aid also covers, or state special education aid also covers the cost for home-based travel and it's reimbursed at a rate of 50% of the travel cost of students or of staff going to family homes. And then we'll pause again for questions on all of these programs.
Thank you. And may I just say what an amazing job your team is doing, keeping things moving here despite even with our questions. So you're doing really well on time. So we're going to got Representative Bolden and Representative Wasniewicz. If folks have something else burning, they can jump in. But I'm hoping we can get through these questions relatively quickly and be able to maybe have a little more time for questions than we had planned at the end, just because we had hardly any time budgeted for that. Representative Bolden, we'll call on you, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be quick. My question is around Head Start and early Head Start and the funding for that. So you spoke to families eligible for that are at or below 100% of the federal poverty limit. I'm wondering if the funding is such that everyone who is at or below that limit can take advantage of those services, or is there a waiting list due to funding? And then my second question is, where does Minnesota fall in terms of funding and opportunity for those programs in relation to, or in comparison to other states?
Not sure who's best to answer that. Looks like maybe Ms. Yetter's going to. And so maybe Ms. Hewitt, whoever is, anybody have a, wanna dive in, more testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bolden. I don't know where we fall compared to other states, but I know that with the state additional funding, we're one of a handful of states that offer that. And so we do serve more than we would be able to without that additional funding. And that we do still have waiting lists. We are not able to meet the need.
Okay, Representative Bolden, looks like no follow-up from you. Okay, Representative Wasniewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if there have been conversations. I know there was an OLA report that came out several years ago that talked about the complexity of the funding and the programming. And I'm wondering if there have been conversations about those concerns within the department or just more broadly. I'm just looking at these slides. I'm like trying to follow all of the different things and I'm a legislator. I'm not a person who's looking to access the program. So wondering if someone could speak to that.
Yeah, maybe Ms. Hewitt.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. It is an amazing number of funding streams to track. And it gets even more complicated when we have part day programming that parents might need full day programming. So then we blend and braid additional funding sources, such as scholarships that you're going to hear about shortly, in order to make that full day programming. It takes an incredibly talented business manager to help with all of these funding streams. And it is something that we're working on to ensure that children and families get what they need. And yet without fully funding an early care and education system, we're doing what's needed to meet the need of children and families.
Representative Wasniewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's just a continued discussion to be having, because it is not only confusing for families sometimes, but also I think difficult for staff to have to figure out how to make all these things work together. So thank you for the opportunity to inquire about
Thank you, Representative Wasniewicz. And I'll point out, of course, this is just in this one department. And then we know that we're finally hearing from this department, and we've been hearing from Department of Human Services, and actually in terms of home visiting, Department of Health as well. So we've got program is spread over multiple agencies. And we may have a proposal coming forward shortly to address at least some of that. Just a quick follow-up on that. I mean, one set of programs is School Readiness Plus and VPK. You talked about the similarity. That may be sort of more at the policy level, but I mean, are there advantages that maybe I'm missing in terms of having those two separate and almost identical programs that you can identify and no need to beg off if that's more sort of at a policy level you don't feel comfortable commenting, but if there's anything that that you can share about that. I guess we can probably miss you, and probably you're on the spot for that.
Representative or Chair, I am struck by the fact that one requires the licensure of a teacher and the other requires the wage compensation similar to K-12. I think that the value of both those programs is that more children are being served, and that's our primary goal in high quality settings.
Okay, all right, fair enough. We'll see if we've got any final question here, and recognizing members, I'm really hoping we'll have just a tiny bit of extra time at the end. So why don't we continue then to our last piece, which I think we have Ms. Myers then swinging in. And so if you can identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Sandy Myers. I'm an early learning services supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I do oversee the Early Learning Scholarship Program. So as you can see from the slide, touching on a lot of points, that's just gonna add a little more complexity to the questions that were just raised. So scholarships are a funding source that the purpose is to close that opportunity gap by increasing access to high quality early childhood programs. Those scholarships can be used at school-based programs, Head Start and Early Head Start, licensed family child care, licensed child care centers that are participating in the Parent Aware Quality Rating System, which I know you've heard about from our DHS colleagues. So eligibility for early learning scholarships are for children that are 3 or 4 years of age on September 1 of the school year within the fiscal year, or if they are in one of four priority populations, that age range is expanded 0 to 4. The income needs to be, for that family, needs to be less than or equal to 185% of the federal poverty level, or a family can demonstrate that they are income eligible by participating in one of 8 public programs that already exist. And I will say that statewide, 75% qualify by already having participated in one of those 8 programs. Children serve, so I've got the last 2 fiscal years pointed out, that we served just over 15,000 in 2019 and a little over 14,000 in 2020. What we're seeing by fewer children served is both children are being served in longer periods of time, so they're maximizing more of the available scholarship that they're able to use, as well as programs are offering more hours in many of the settings that the families can have their child participate in. We're continuing to watch as we also started looking at that cap, which currently right now is capped at $7,500 per scholarship if that family chooses to enroll their child in a 4-star rated program. But just beginning in fiscal year 21, that was raised to $10,000 for those children that are in the priority population. So I'd like to move into that area. So the priority population are those children of teen parents that are pursuing a high school diploma or GED, have experienced or are experiencing homelessness within the last 24 months, and children that are either currently in foster care or have been designated in need of child protective services. And those priority settings were added in 2018, which was the first year we implemented that. So again, early learning programs that are eligible are based on their parent aware rating, and again, maybe any of those program types. We have two different ways a child may access a scholarship. We have Pathway 1, where families apply to one of 12 area administrators, 12 of which are geographically based and two are tribal. Those are Leech Lake and White Earth nations that participate as scholarship administrators. And then Pathway 2 is awarded by 4-star rated parent aware programs that have applied to administer a certain number of seats or scholarships. And they award them to families that have already chosen them by enrollment and or by being on their wait list. They can award those scholarships to either of those categories. Because this is a funding stream, there isn't necessarily an outcome measure other than the child has been awarded the scholarship and they are attending a high quality program. However, assessment is required at all programs with a 3 or 4-star rating. We also make sure that all children are assigned that state student identification number, and that could be used down the road at other factors, such as if a statewide KEP was implemented, we'd be able to, you know, tie backwards children that benefited from an early learning program by nature of a scholarship. There also is a statement in the statute that all children must be screened, that early childhood screening, within 90 days of receiving a scholarship or within 90 days of their third birthday if they are under the age of 3 and received one of those scholarships when they were 0 to 3.
If you just go back for a second, one important point that I don't see in these slides on scholarships, if you can just talk about, is that I understand that there is a cap in terms of the amount of funding that can be received by programs. I think it's like $7,500. Can you just talk about the amount of money that that goes with each child under this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can do that. That was what I was mentioning earlier. The scholarship cap is $7,500 per child at a 4-star rated, it's 5,000 at a 3-star, 4,000 at a 1 or 2. And if it's a program that is in the process of being parent aware rated, they are eligible to accept scholarships, but it's capped at 3,000 until they earn their rating. And then the scholarship can go up proportionate to what their rating is. I think what you also might be meaning is back in 2 years ago, the statute was capped Pathway 2 eligibility. So that total amount of funding was capped at the amount of funding that was awarded in fiscal year 2017. So in the increase that we've had the last 3 years in the scholarship fund, none of the new money went to Pathway 2. It all went to Pathway 1. Hopefully that answers your question.
No, that's very helpful. Thanks. Yeah, my apologies for having said that earlier. So yeah, please continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Next slide, Shanna. So here is the funding for 2021. We are currently at $70.709 million. Our funding is now in a special revenue account, which has been very helpful. As great a job as our 12 area administrators do in trying to forecast and maximize every dollar and award as many scholarships as they can, family lives change. They may enroll in a program and then end up not being able to use it all. A family may not have childcare assistance, and then they come off the waiting list, and so they're able to layer and blend their funding. And so at the end of every fiscal year, there was funding that was left that was awarded, but it wasn't spent. Now we're able to roll that forward and re-grant it out. So more and more children will continue to be funded rather than those funds being lost back to the general fund, which was the intent of those dollars to begin with. I do want to call out a report that we do every year. So we want to make sure that anybody that has more detailed questions about how scholarships are used, where they're used, what families are using them, what children are, we publish a scholarship use report. And January 14th, we just released the state fiscal year 2020, and I believe the fiscal year 2019 is up as well. So if anybody wants to dive into a lot more deeper details, they certainly can do that. And I've got a couple slides, or one more slide, I think, on the next page that will kind of break that down a little bit. So you can see the breakdown of total scholarships from 1 year to the next, so using 2019 and 2020. The biggest area I want to point out is in the priority populations, and that would be any of those children 0 to age kindergarten when they age out. We are seeing a growth in the number of awards because they have now been prioritized. So if there is a waiting list in any of our area administrators, if they have a child with priority status and they've been able to identify through forecasting or if any new funds, children that are in a priority status are funded first. And you can see that as evidence, the largest category is families experiencing homelessness. However, we are working very closely with our DHS colleagues in family and child permanency to make sure that all county and tribal social service workers know that early learning scholarships is a resource that they can try to support their families accessing, particularly because there is no work requirement for families. Early learning scholarships is a child-focused funding source, and so it really can help stabilize other family goals and program components that the family might be participating in while their child's benefiting from a high-quality learning experience.
Ms. Myers, I think Chair Dabney has a question. I think that you're almost done. And so Representative Dabney, I'm thinking that I think this is maybe the last slide before questions. And so I think we'll have you, Ms. Myers, finish this up. Representative Dabney, speak up if there's more urgent than that, but I suspect that you're fine with just having, we'll do this slide and then go to Chair Dabney first. Okay, great. Yeah, so Ms. Myers, why don't you wrap up if you can? This is great. And then we'll move to questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is my last slide. I just wanted to give you a quick snapshot. This data was pulled on December 21st, just so you could see that we are continuing, or the area administrators and the school districts, Head Starts, Child Care that have Pathway 2 are continuing to award and enroll and serve children even during this public health crisis. The numbers in Pathway 1 are a little lower only because they're ensuring that they're holding money to renew any scholarships where a child was awarded in a previous year and they continue to remain eligible. And because Pathway 2 must be used for children that either are enrolled or on their waiting list, we request that they get those funds awarded as early in the school year or the fiscal year as possible. And again, you can see again the focus on those priority populations. So I think that ends the data and the information I'd like to share. So if there are any questions, happy to answer them.
Thank you so much, Ms. Myers. Yeah, and we're I think we're at the end of the presentations now. So Chair Dabney, we'll go to you and then see what other questions folks have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Ms. Myers, slide 36, could we just pop that back up briefly, if that's all right with the chair.
Yeah, please showed, do that.
If I was reading it correctly, some pretty sharp increases in students experiencing homelessness being accessing the scholarship system and students in foster care, children. These aren't students, they're children. Sorry, my K-12 background is driving my mouth this morning, apparently. So both sharp increases in students experiencing homelessness and children in foster care. Are they being primarily served by the Pathway 1 or the Pathway 2 scholarships?
Ms. Myers.
I'm not able to discern that from my read of this table.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, they are right as of now primarily being served through Pathway 1 through scholarships. What I can't answer though is what Pathway 2 programs that may be receiving Pathway 2 may already be serving children in these categories. They're just not using scholarships to fund their seats. So I always want to be careful to differentiate that. Whereas with Pathway 1, they're serving either children that previously had a Pathway 1 scholarship or new referrals to them, newly identified children, where Pathway 2, because the based on statute, they're either already enrolled and or on their wait list. So again, more of these are being representative in Pathway 1, but that doesn't necessarily mean the Pathway 2 aren't serving them, if that helps.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification. I need to spend more time with the statute. I notice in the priority population, English language learners are not one of those priority populations. Yet I recall a few years ago, MDE had a report showing that for young English language learners, the Pathway 2 scholarships were more positively impactful. Am I reading that we're not prioritizing English language learners in these scholarships correctly?
Can you talk about that, Ms. Myers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, yes, I can. They are not called out in statute as having priority to receive a scholarship. However, by nature of the need many of those families have and the need to have their children in a high-quality early learning program, they are still dramatically being served at a much higher rate in programs that receive Pathway 2 funding than those that are receiving, or than those that have Pathway 1 scholarship and have gone that route. So I can share, and this is in the full scholarship use report, all these details, but Pathway 2 in 2020, languages spoken other than English of those that chose to answer the question was nearly 24%, but in Pathway 1, it was under 10%. So that trend is continuing now, even to 2020. And I think part of that is, go ahead.
Oh, no, pardon me, Ms. Myers.
Ms. Myers, but why don't you finish up?
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Chair. I was just going to say, and if you think about many of the program types that have Pathway 2 funds, they already, based on the nature of their overall program goals, such as Head Start, Early Head Start, school readiness, child care programs that have a mission base, they're already targeting and reaching out to those communities. So it only makes sense that their Pathway 2 scholarships would follow.
Representative Downey, follow up?
If I may, just one more question. Earlier, Ms. Hewitt referenced the importance of alignment between early childhood and the K-12 system. How do we assure alignment between programs that receive scholarships, particularly the Pathway 1 scholarships where it's so atomized, and K-12?
Ms. Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney. That's where the link between early learning scholarships and the Parent Aware quality rating system comes into play. So Parent Aware has identified a set of indicators that align with early childhood indicators of progress, the measures that all types of early childhood programs, either by nature of the statute that they operate under, or going through the Parent Aware rating process, they're demonstrating that they're offering that high quality experience that would blend with that alignment, regardless of the setting.
Dabney.
All right. Further. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Myers.
And certainly an ongoing conversation on all of this. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Myers. My question, thinking about that racial equity lens in regards to the scholarships, I'm wondering if we are tracking, and perhaps this is in the report that you mentioned, and I certainly can take a look at that, but I'm wondering if we are tracking the sort of percentage or the number of these scholarships that are going to white families versus families of color.
Ms. Myers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bolden, yes, all that detail is in the report, and we do have it broken down by race and ethnicity and families that identify themselves as white. And I can say statewide, 32% of scholarship recipients identify themselves as white. This is an optional question, so if we have 14% that did not answer, but all other families do identify their child as non-white if they answered the question. So the majority of scholarships are going to racially diverse children.
Okay. And if I can just ask real quickly on that scholarship slide, the distribution, am I right in thinking, because it doesn't show ages, but right in thinking that the majority continue to be to 3 and 4 year olds, And then with a smaller number to 0 to 2 year olds. Is that generally correct, Ms. Myers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is still correct, though we are seeing a larger number of infants and toddlers as a proportion of the total population, particularly in pathway one. And again, that would make sense when you follow the program types, as regular Head Start and school-based programs primarily only serve 3 and 4 year olds. And so you take that group out for infants and toddlers. But for pathway one, 40% of the scholarships in fiscal year 2020 were for infants and toddlers. So those under the age of 3.
That's helpful, thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we could look at slide 36 again that we were just on, and I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what this is telling us just in terms of the numbers. The number of children receiving scholarships overall has gone down between 2019 and 2020.
Ms. Myers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor. Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Myers. And then can you again talk about what we attribute that to? I mean, I don't think that the amount of money and funding for scholarships went down in that year, but the number of children receiving scholarships, and maybe you explained it before and I just need to hear it again so I understand.
Ms. Myers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor. So it's a variety of factors. It's children using a larger proportion of their scholarship, which is a good thing, which means they're enrolling in programs earlier from the time they are awarded their scholarship to when that scholarship starts being used. That was not always the case historically, where it took families a long time to figure out where could they use their scholarship. So I think that speaks to a lot of the outreach and the support that our area administrators are providing to families, as well as many are using it for longer periods of time during the week. So they're getting more services. So in general, it's just the cost being used, or the amount of the scholarship being used per child is increasing.
Gotcha. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Myers. And I know that you said that before, and but I appreciate that, taking that moment to repeat it. And so even if I look at those priority populations, because those numbers increased, and when we said those are priority populations, if you're homeless, if you're a child living in foster care, these are, you know, probably situations that are more challenging, and that I can see where we're now serving mostly a more at-risk population that needs this, even if it means that we're serving less people overall.
Thank you. If we can come back to, I think that was more of a statement than a question, unless I misunderstood. But if we can come back to take down the presentation if we can. I'm not seeing any other questions. I have one question, which is, data on long-term outcomes, in terms of high school graduation, involvement in use of social services, employment, wages, et cetera. Do we have that? My guess is the answer is no. And then sort of what would we need to do to get her? Just if you can talk about that as opposed to just sort of program participation, but that sense of long-term outcomes. I assume this is directed to Ms. Hewitt.
We do not. Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. We do not have that information. And I think it is something that we have been considering and looking at how we might obtain that. We're certainly working on building the data system that has been described and looking at how that early childhood data system can be linked to the K-12 data system to gather additional information. It's something that we would have to continue to build out and support with resources, as well as just all of the scope of the work that would need to be done with our Minute colleagues.
I'll note it seems like it'd be a pretty major data challenge because you have to have a unique identifier. The child's in multiple different programs, has to travel with them. You then have to be able to see, you have to sort of study over the long run. I'll maybe note for staff that I'm trying to remember if we talked about the early childhood longitudinal data system yet in the committee. That may be something that we can at least address briefly on Tuesday. Members, we're pretty much out of time. I want to thank our four amazing presenters and Sheena Morse with the department for pulling this together. You had an amazing challenge before you, and you just met it really, really well, and we're really grateful. If you can provide us with follow-up answers to some of the questions asked, we'd most appreciate that quite a bit. Members, on Tuesday, we're going to be hearing about the governor's budget and hearing from the Children's Cabinet, which connects to many of the pieces we've heard over the last few weeks. Members, thanks so much, members of the public, and with that, we are adjourned.